This year, we're looking at complexity, and a number of you will have been at our November meeting, where we had these short talks about various aspects of science and spirituality, and you will remember that Vasily gave a short talk there, which is very captivating, sort of complexity in 10 minutes. And this time we've given them a bit more time. Vasily was one of the people working with Ilya Prigozhin when he was a younger researcher. And we had Ilya Prigozhin over here in 1995, so that's now 20 years ago. And we had 420 people coming to a one-day conference at Regent's College with him, Brian Goodwin, and John Pockinghorn. But it just showed that this enormous drawing power of Prigozhin, and I'm sure he may have a few stories about Prigozhin, probably weren't relevant to. Anyway, he's been working in this field for a long time, now a senior researcher at ULB, Université Libre de Bruxelles, very old friend of mine and a very old friend of the network. And so it's a true delight to have you here with us, Vasily, and we look forward to what you have to say, and we'll be testing it all to destruction later later in the morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, and it's not my first annual gathering, but it's the first that I have this wonderful opportunity to talk about a subject that I love to people that I love. So it's for me, I am in the seventh heaven. So you have to stop me sometime, because I might get carried away. The story starts with the end of the mechanistic thinking in late 18th century. That's where we can start thinking that complexity is emerging from. And from this end of the century until now, there is a body of knowledge that we call complexity science. And by the way, if you noticed before, I changed my talk from complexity sciences to complexity science, because it's really a unified theme throughout a vast array of different subjects and academic disciplines. But it is a unifying theme, and complexity science, it might be better in singular than in plural. What does this bring us? Many breakthroughs that I try to group them in three major themes. One is that we are exhausting the dogma of mechanistic reductionism. The other one is that by doing that, we are creating, or a science is being created that is a totally new kind of science, a science that is more self-reflecting, a science that it's more epistemological in the sense that it reflects its own foundation, and it has to talk and make conscious the scientists dealing with that science of their own assumptions, their own hypotheses, their own working habits. And then by engaging this in this way, somehow the world transforms, and we are not anymore in a hostile universe, a giant machine, but rather we are in a universe which is more like us, a being with a body and a soul. So we start from this one. When, as I mentioned before, in the end of the Victorian era, or should I say in the middle of the Victorian era, where the Industrial Revolution was fully blown, mechanistic thinking was dominating everything. And everything would like to be casted with wheels and cogs turning around. And James Clerk Maxwell, who is, the greatest scientist ever, by trying to put the ideas of his mentor and good friend Faraday into a mathematical framework, he devised a machine with cogs and wheels to explain the electromagnetic field. And he managed to explain the electromagnetic field by failing to provide the mechanism. So his cogs and wheels dropped down, his construction collapsed, and out of this collapse, the new idea of a field as a dominant idea in physics emerged. A field is a very non-linear thing, and it's malleable, and it changes, and it occupies space and time. But the real person who really saw chaos, the face of chaos in front of him, was Poincaré. Poincaré was another street scientist of wonderful, and he's the advisor of Rigozhin. So it's somehow what Rigozhin is the advisor of my advisor, Poincaré is the, anyway, so it's my grand. So he was a wonderful man who was being studying very advanced topics in classical and celestial dynamics. And he had dealing with a problem which is called the three-body problem. The three-body problem is two-body problem plus one, obviously. So two-body problem is when the standard Kepler problem where Isaac Newton solved in completely in the beginning of the Enlightenment. And it deals with the sun and the planets orbiting around them. There you have very simple geometrical forms that the trajectories take, which are what they call conic sections, but doesn't matter. It's ellipses, circles, parabolas, and it's all things that go around the sun in an orderly way. They behave nicely and very predictable. But imagine now you have two suns and one planet. Then the situation becomes really complicated. This is a new computer graphics. Poincaré could not see that in his computer screen because there were no computer screens at that time. Now, every first year graduate can do that and draw the face of chaos. It's very complicated trajectory with respect to a circle, an ellipse, or a hyperbola, or a parabola. But Poincaré tried to imagine it with his mind's eye, and he was kind of desperate. He couldn't find a way to put that into context, to explain that to his colleagues. He was a very shy man, and he wanted to be very precise. To his aid comes Adamar, another friend of his, who provides a motion in a field where you have special dependence on initial conditions. That means that if you have little balls in a special field with negative curvature, and you let them roll down the hill, they will go in different ways, no matter how close they start from. This is what is called also the butterfly effect. It has been exemplified by the flaps of the wing of a butterfly that might cause a tornado in Calcutta, that might cause a tornado in Texas. So that was another metaphor of chaos and the complex dynamics that emerge from that. There's another set of non-linear chaotic systems that appeared in early century, and that was actually the breakthrough of complex systems in physical and chemical sciences. It was the genius of Belousov who went against the first law of thermodynamics. Like Newton's law, the first and second law of thermodynamics say that you cannot go back from an equilibrium that has been reached by a chemical reaction. So the whole universe will go finally to an equilibrium and death by equilibrating all the possible reactions around him. That was the dogma of the era until Belousov was playing with his chemicals and he found a very non-linear, in a sense, a very kind of complicated reaction, but nevertheless a reaction which would oscillate. So this is something which was very irritating. I mean, it was really frustrating to see a reaction you put in your beakers up there. You see the beakers are in the not moving picture up there. You put two reactants. They react. They end up in a product, and then this product dissolves itself and goes back to the reactants and goes on forever and ever. So Belousov was kind of criticized for everything. He says that it cannot be done. This is not what you see. This is really, you are making a sloppy experiment. Go back. He was disappointed and really went away from academia, very being disappointed and sad. And it took like 30 or 40 years until a graduate student was taking the task to clean up Belousov's mess and give an explanation. And that was Zabotinsky, who did not clean up Belousov's mess. He made it into a paradigm that everybody has to take into consideration. At that time, Brygozin provided the first mathematical description of this non-chemical, non-linear chemical reaction, which, if you again see it as a field, is an ever-changing, it changes little by little. This is the computer simulation of the Belousov-Zabotinsky reaction, or Brucellator, as they call it, because of Brygozin. So these things are changing forever and ever. The pattern, which was would be a uniform kind of product in the end, it becomes a field of ever-changing patterns because of the underlying chaotic oscillations of this reaction. So chaos in a field makes patterns. This is a realization coming from physical chemistry and providing Brygozin with the impetus to propose an array of breakthrough ideas, groundbreaking ideas. So he challenged the system, the second law of thermodynamics, that the universe is going to an end, by just opening the universe, saying that are we really talking about a closed system where the second law applies when we're talking about the universe? So the universe, if it's open, it will keep on going and regenerating itself forever. No need for any death. This mechanism of generation are the dissipative structures that like a tornado. A tornado is a dissipative structure where it takes in and gives out. It takes in energy, gives out energy and matter. And all these things happen with a spontaneous symmetry breaking. That means that you don't have a very homogeneous field, but patterns are emerging, which means that the things are self-organized. They are organized by themselves. They are not going to be organized by imposing a hierarchy or external forcing. They just happen to organize by themselves in groups. And the basis of that is non-linear feedback and a self-referential thing. We'll come back to the self-referential thing. It's an old age question and has been used in philosophy forever and ever to expand views. What I like to in this picture of Brygozin is that in his blackboard there is a note there which says Turing 1952, and indeed it was when Brygozin met Turing at Manchester, and I wonder if Max Payne was around at that time in 1952. Was he? That was the sad last years of Turing. After 2 years, he committed suicide. But Brygozin remembers a young researcher approaching him and handing him his new paper in 1952, which was called The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis. He took and complaining that other people would never have a look at that paper, which they didn't. I mean, they completely ignore it, because Turing was a great man in computer science, so what he can say about chemical kinetics. So you see the interdisciplinarity of complexity already, even from the beginning. Turing finds Brygozin and asks for help in his chemical kinetics. Brygozin takes the paper and really gets inspired. He has been saying that ever since, by the brilliance of this young man, and he cannot find him because in 2 years, sadly, Turing disappeared from this world. I mean, he passed away. So Brygozin takes the challenge of Turing to explain morphogenesis, the genesis of forms. And in the basis of that, he finds a dynamical basis of morphogenesis in the form of what we call now chaotic strange attractors, or dissipative structures at the time of Brygozin. And there you have an equilibrium which is equilibrium in one way and disequilibrium in the other way. This interplay between equilibrium and disequilibrium is a new thing that complexity brings in the old ideas of equilibrium. So there you see the epitome of a strange attractor, which is called the Lorentz attractor, and it's part of the description of a cyclone, of turbulence in the atmosphere. In the other side is another dissipative structure, which is Ressler attractor. These two are the archetypes of chaotic motion. What is interesting there is that the motion will never repeat itself. It will go on and forever and ever and ever and ever, but in a regular way. So it will jump from one place to another in irregular way, and the statistics of the jumps are the same, but each realization of each jump is totally different because of the sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So Poincaré would be very happy to see this graphic, because this is the thing that he put in his mind, saying to his friend Hamadar, I see such a structure in my mind that I don't dare even to describe it to you, dear friend. So we are pretty close to understand what Poincaré saw. This is the face of chaos, an ever-repeating pattern. This they discover that it's a very natural object, which is called fractal. And no matter how close you go to this trajectory, you will find more and more of the same. More and more of the same because of self-reference and because of the non-linear substratum that holds this mathematical structure. This object is a new object which describes a new geometry called the fractal geometry, which kind of becomes quite popular these days. It's everywhere. When we have lunch later and we have broccoli, see, you can observe the structure of the broccoli. This is an example of a fractal. Or a tree is a fractal. Clouds are fractals. Our lungs are fractals. The beating of our heart is fractal. It's a geometry with more of organic form, so to speak. And for me, what is fascinating with the world of fractals is that no matter how deep you go or no matter how up you go, as above, so below, you are always surrounded by an infinite depth and an infinite height above your head and down under your feet. So this reminds us the old dictum, as above, so below, as within, so without. And which brings us to really contemplate about what kind of science, hello Meredith, what kind of science is this complexity science that is emerging from all these breakthroughs. It's a radically new science in the sense not only that it brings nice computer graphics, fractals, and mysterious things, but because it requires a different way of dealing with a reality which is multifaced and interdisciplinary, from chemical kinetics to mathematics to dynamical systems or sociological and biological systems. Complexity pervades in a horizontal way almost everything. For example, I have a nice movie with this bird. It's my favorite movie. So, and the ones that have seen it before, I think that you can bear to see it once more. The starlings, yes. This is an example of a complex system that will be more and more in our minds for the next decades to come, because there are many questions there. Is this one object or many? It consists of interacting individuals. Each one has his own life. He has his starling family, and they all live under a group of a pattern of relations. They all participate in something bigger than themselves. They dance all together, and this is called a hyper or super organism, like the bees or an ant colony, or a human society. It has a life of its own. We will go back to this life of this being, which is a collection of many beings. And it's an example of a complex systems as we understand it now, after half a century of introduction to complexity by Brygger and Turing in Poincaré. For me, it brings to mind the wisdom of the ages, where you probably know this example, the blind man examining an elephant, where each one gives his own version of an elephant, and finally one has to reconstruct a partial elephant, something which looks like that thing above, because the guy who feels the belly of the elephant thinks that it's a big wall that he has in front of him. The other guy who feels the legs of the elephant will see that he has trees in front of him. The other guy, he sees spears and the snake instead of his elephant trunk and all that. So if you try to recombine all these things, you get something which resembles an elephant, but you have to make always remind yourself, you have to make yourself always aware that this is a partial description of different projections of a being, of a different, more complicated thing. In our days, we will draw the elephant like a complex system of networks interconnected with relations and charts and equations, more like in the something which resembles the diagram below. But still, if we are honest enough, and if we agree that our description is not the complete description, like the mechanistic, naive reductions will argue, but there are many other complementary, equally true descriptions, then we can have a more complete picture of a complex system. So the elephant as a complex system brings again forth the complexification of our thought in mathematics. So let me take you back again in the 30s, where this self-referential non-linear thinking has been applied to the core of mathematics by in the 30s in the Vienna Circle took up the task of putting all science in a big machine that will turn and provide all possible scientific explanations in one big objective description. And that was the positivists in Vienna, until Gödel came and he turned the argument on its head by a non-linear sentence asking, if we have this machine that can answer any question, what is the answer to this question? Is this sentence provable or unprovable? Is this sentence is unprovable, yes or no? If our machine says yes, it's no. Because if it's unprovable, it's not provable, right? So, but if our machine says no, then it's yes. So our machine is encountering, it should go to an equilibrium saying yes or no for sure, but instead of that, goes to an oscillation. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, all the time. So the example that we have from chemical reactions, that they should stop somewhere, but they don't. They keep on repeating themselves because the mechanism, the underlying reality is self-referential. It reflects in our logical structures in the same kind of way. The underlying sentence is self-referential, and it blows up the whole machinery. After that, Turing and Chaitin provided, again Turing, the genius of Turing, provided the framework for posing such questions in real computer science, and Chaitin also, for once and for all, completed this theory to the extent that mathematics now, it's not a... There's no machine that can make mathematics for us. There's always an element of art and of creativity that has to be associated with our mathematical models. There's no... machines are nice, but they have to be guided by our intuition. So intuition guides the proof, and not the other way around that the Posivits will think in the beginning of the Vienna Circle. By the way, if you want the whole story of the Vienna Circle, it's a very nice comics by two compatriots of mine. One is in University of California, Doxialis and Papa Dimitriou. Logicomics is a nice comics narrating this history of the end of positivism. Yeah, there you see Wittgenstein is suffering there. So because of the frustration that he's going to get from all this new nonlinear thinking by given by Gödel, and Russell is in front, cool and not really upset about the situation. Anyway, it's a very nice comment. So now let's go to this motion. Go back to the Sterlings. They are a wonder to see them. And there are peculiar facts. Not a single collision has ever been recorded. These are millions, sometimes, of beings dancing in the dusk. The biological function of this dance is not very well clear. Maybe there are many biological functions. Maybe like grooming before going to bed. But I think that a biologist who was working with the great Brian Goodwin, when I asked him what he thinks about that, he said that I know the secret. They dance because they can. So there are many questions pervading complex systems that are open still. And let me make a slight diversion now. From social animals to human societies. In economics, treat them. They want to put themselves in the shoes of an exact scientist. So economists would love to have a mechanistic explanation of economy, and they would love to justify their possession with free market and or even the human nature of greed to make it as something which is we cannot live without. To this indoctrination by the mechanistic indoctrination in social science and economics, there is an example, a paradigmatic situation where they call it the tragedy of commons. And the tragedy of commons consists of the following rationale. You have a field that people graze their cows and sheep. And they are rational individuals. They want to maximize their profits. For me, I already read that greedy guys. Each one, and there's no regulation, so each one puts more and more cows. The field is depleted. All cows die. This is a tragedy of the commons. We should regulate the commons, our wise economists say, by state or privatization. So you have either state control, which is like the communist state, or extreme privatization. Nothing belongs to anybody. Everyone has his own patch of land, and he's responsible for himself. So forget communities and forget any kind of sharing. Our economists claim that we have a tragedy of commons if we share things. the best criticism is a book named Think Like a Commoner, which it's free. You can download it because it has to be shared, right? By David Bollier. And the description is wonderful because the tragedy thesis be called instead the tragedy, not of commons, but of unmanaged, laissez-faire, common pool resources, which is the field, with easy access. That means everybody can go in and out, no community, nobody who is watching, for non-communicating, self-interested individuals, which means greedy people and the first came, first served for the whole thing. So this is not really a rational human being. A rational human being has more of a dialogue with his fellow beings. And this is a criticism, again, from the tragedy of commons, coming from cartoons. And the couple goes to the movies, to the theater, and it's on now playing the tragedy of commons. And the man protests. He says, I hear it lacks dialogue. And it does. It does lack dialogue. And the dialogue to this problem was introduced by a great woman, Elinor Ostrom, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2009 for her analysis of economic governance. To make a long story short, she has been complexifying the problem of commons. The tragedy of commons is this first thing, simple loop of reactions that will lead to more and more demand of resources and then depletion and exponential explosion of everything. She put regulation and communication and dialogue between the agents. And what she provided was another complex mathematical system which gives another outcome. It's more like, it's not oscillation this time, but it's a sustainable development. Another thing that we have to learn about the commons is that it's a long history of the commons, and this year we celebrate the 800 years of Magna Carta, which is considered to be the capstone of the commons. Magna Carta formulated for the first time the rights of people to collaborate and also the rights of not being depleted their resources, habeas corpus and all that. So there is a limit of what the other people and the state and the market in our days can impose to communities. Today it's called the public trust doctrine, and for people who like history, the first distinction formalized was when one of the first Christian kings of East Rome, of Byzantine, Justin, because of the influence of Christianity, proclaimed three kind of things: things that belong to nobody, res nullius; things that belong to the state, which is res publica, republic; and things that they don't belong to anybody, and they are the things communis. So these are the commons at the time. Anyway, today it goes by the public trust doctrine in Switzerland. Yes, thanks. Here, this is supposedly the tragedy of the commons. The funny thing that we learn, and my dear wife reminded me, because it was really a surprise to learn from this book, that in Switzerland there are people and there are communities that they have exactly this situation, common herding grounds, in a stable, sustainable way, regulated by themselves, very simple rules. As many cows as you can host in your stables during the winter, so many you can breed in the common land. You cannot bring more than that. Very simple rule, and it has been sustained from 1400 or 1350 something. So imagine there was no tragedy of commons ever in the real situation, because people just communicate and had a dialogue with them. The economists, by simplifying that and making it so reductionistic model of that, they came up with a scary thing that we should trust either the market or the state in order to deal with our commons. And until Ostrom comes in, where she says that no, we can have a polycentric governance and new things can emerge from that. One of my favorite authors has written this wonderful book, and his Highness, His Royal Highness, right? I'm not British subject, so I'm not very good with it. So what is a very interesting development is that for the 800 years of Magna Carta, he put forth the idea of a Magna Carta for the Earth, which is a wonderful idea. And by declaring the habeas corpus of our mountains and oceans and birds that fly free and they don't belong to anybody, and things that we can share and not have it as a private thing for exploitation, but more that we become stewards of our home, which is everything around us on there, on Earth. So maybe it's not that late to change the paradigm and become stewards rather than proprietors of our Earth. So this is a new kind of science, which in a nutshell, I would say that it allows for non-paradigmatic thinking, because paradigms come and go and they don't capture the whole of the story. So you have to be able to jump from one to another and bring in all kinds of different approaches. The validation and dialogue across disciplines, we saw how from chemical kinetics and chaotic dynamics they could merge into a new synthesis in the early days of complexity. Allow metaphor to guide research and not dogma. That was the case of Belousov, where he just played with his reactions and he wanted to provide something new without, which was not already inscribed in the dogma of the day. And somehow, by allowing... hello. Hi. So, and somehow, by allowing one nested hierarchy in inside the other, it's my feeling that we allow for the equivalent of the soul of the cosmos to come back in our description of the cosmos. This is from inspired by the as above, so below, and the fractals that bring a new kind of understanding of scales all over, permeating everywhere. And yes, of course, keep conscious of our assumptions, never take them so seriously, be able to judge them and play with them and have fun with them, not take them dogmatically correct. And something that comes from a very dear friend, a philosopher who claims to be an essayist, as you have said, Martin has described that. Emilius Buratinos was always telling us that it's not only what you are reducing to, which is cogs and wheels in the mechanistic science, but you have always to remember where you are reducing it from. Because mechani, the machine, the old Greek word, is actually means a device of the mind. All he sees was a polymechanistic, in the sense that he will bring forth, his mind will devise stuff. So this device of our mind now has been enslaving us for enlightenment and on, thinking that this is all there is. The most anthropocentric and anthropomorphic metaphor became the real thing. You cannot, if it's not a machine, it's not a scientific thing. So we have to be careful where we are reducing our mechanistic philosophy from. So let me go a little fast on that, because it's, I mean, knowing scientific and medical network, you already know better than me this, that the world is a interconnected organic whole, and it's a mindful cosmos rather than a machine. What I would like to stress is that in complexity, in a nutshell, as a diagram, we have systems that lie in between simple ordered and simple disordered systems. So at one hand, in the top, you have systems which look like an army, very, very rigorous, very organized, everything is square and nice, and everything is... the most thing that you can do is having a periodic order. And the other extreme, the further down, is total randomness. No rules, nothing. Everything is at the whims of chance. In between, complex systems are deterministic but unpredictable. They are structured but with a variety and plasticity of structure, like the fractals. And they have patterns instead of just a rigorous greed or nothing at all. So, and this is your, I'm sure they have seen it many times. Where's Bernard? There. So this comes from Bernard seminars and books. The universe, it becomes a being in itself, in the sense that it determines and self-determines itself. The more down you go to the last particle, the more information you need from the cosmological realm, that in order to understand what's going in the very very dense, small world in the quantum realm. If you go again up into the galaxies and black holes and galactic dynamics and cosmological distribution of things, then again you need to have the very little constituencies of matter in order to explain. In between, there is a cosmos of complex systems that, and we think now that life and intelligence is sustained somewhere in this region. The bacteria is out. But bacteria as complex systems and can also have a very, very intelligent behavior sometimes. This is another trend that you will be hearing a lot. Simple organisms like bacteria, slime, ants, bees, with little brains and having very, very intelligent behavior. So why should we stop consciousness and intelligence in the human realm? If the cosmos is full of complex systems that they can sustain very complex information pathways and intelligent exchanges, why not change our assumptions that consciousness is something that belongs to man and not in accordance with great minds like Adamar and Poincaré and Gödel, believe that and start as a scientific hypothesis that consciousness is everywhere, is primordial, and it's in the basis of the reality where things emanate from. I think that in this century we will see this becoming not only a nice, sweet metaphor, but a scientific hypothesis capable of producing new results. And these new results, that they will justify that consciousness is not only part of the human condition, I think it will come from complex systems research. That was actually Gödel's questions. And he asked a very precise question, always asked, he was asking precise questions, whether we can reduce everything to mechanical substratum, one-to-one interpretation of all the functions of the life and mind. Can we do that? The answer that he would give is no. Life cannot be reduced in mechanical processes. And not only life and human body, but even the smallest bug cannot be reduced into a machine. It has a mechanical part, of course, but it cannot be reduced to a machine. A good example, I think I have other things to go through fast, but just a small anecdote here with Leibniz coming in, a royal ball. He was escorting a high aristocracy lady, and he stops in the middle of his step to the royal chamber, and picks up a spider from his. On that it was found on their way. I think she was a baroness something, anyway, a duchess of something. She said, but very good friend of Leibniz, he said, but dear Gottfried, what are you doing here? This is an embarrassment. I mean, everybody's waiting, everybody's looking, and you, instead of escorting me, you are taking care of a spider. She teased him. And he replied, well, madam, I would have crushed it only if I could make it. These things, I don't have the right to destroy something that I cannot know how to make. Leibniz, like Newton and all the great mystics behind the Enlightenment, believed in the sacredity of life, and they also believed that life could be an automaton, but an infinitely complicated automaton, whether man can only make machines which are finite, complicated automaton. Anyway, a small digression. Just to tire you a little more, drawing analogs between quantum mechanics and complex systems, and one of them is complementarity of structure and function. We all know the complementarity of wave and particle. This comes actually from Niels Bohr being inspired by function and structure complementarity in complex systems. When you have a complex system, for example, here is a macrophage who is entering and he wants to eat a bacterium. Now, this macrophagus, which is our T cells, that they attack bacteria to destroy them, is comprised by little machines which are proteins, and this is a hemoglobin. But he has an intention. His intention is to eat the bacterium. Could we map this intention in mechanical processes, and at what level? If we go down to the proteins, further down to their structure, ternary and secondary and primary structure, we end up in the realm of particles and intention and motion, and biology evaporates at that level. So we have to be careful when we're looking at the structure of things not to forget the complementarity of their function. And when we look at the function of things, not to forget the complementarity of their structure. It's the same situation in quantum mechanics. Again, you have a phenomenon which is called tunneling, where literally you can go through walls. Not to be suggested in everyday life, but quantum mechanical particles, they are very common to go through barriers. And there are many schools of explaining that, but still, it's something kind of a paradox. Like the guy who is making, who enjoys his ski afternoon and doesn't bother avoiding trees. So quantum tunneling is really literally going through walls. Another phenomenon, but this time at the information level, not at the physical level, is a phenomenon coming from non-linear complex systems, and it has to do with pattern formation and noise. So I will ask you to look at the movie. It's not going to take that long. You see, this is a Turing instability that creates a Turing pattern. And then I add noise, with a computer. By adding noise, the pattern is destroyed and goes away. The system is not organized anymore. Then, as this goes up, means that we add more and more and more and more noise. Okay, the pattern remains destroyed. We add more noise, which means more distraction, and more distraction brings forth a coherence and more noise and clearer message. So this is equivalent in information space with what happens in tunneling in real space, physical space. We literally go through information walls provided by noise. And the message can go through a noisy environment. This has tremendous implications in biology, in brain dynamics, in recognition, signal recognition for biological systems. And this is still unexplored, although we now know that the mathematical skeleton, the mathematical framework of these two is one-to-one correspondence. If people who study stochastic resonance can study the mathematics of tunneling, and people who study the mathematics of tunneling can study stochastic resonance, it's one-to-one. But we lack dialogue still between the disciplines. And we are frustrated. And this is another dictum of Brygosin that I like. He said that you cannot solve non-linear problem with linear thinking. And non-linear thinking means that we think we should start thinking like with a logic and understanding processes rather than objects. And that's what Didik Arch has done. That's very recent research. 2013 and 2014, this book came up, which is Quantum Models of Cognition and Decision. What is quantum models of cognition decision? It has nothing to do with quantum mechanics of small particles. It has to do how we are dealing with our concepts. And according to Arts, and he provides a very good argument for that, concepts are more quantum entities than classical objects. They are more diffuse, more liquid, more wave-like, so to speak. They more describing processes, described as processes than as objects. And let me give you a quick example for that. Imagine that you are taking a poll in the beginning of the 90s where Gore and Clinton are running as a team. And then you approach your audience and you ask, would you like Al Gore? You say, yes or no. And then you ask, would you like Bill Clinton? Yes or no. Yes, 53% Gore is okay and Clinton is okay, you get 76% approval for Gore and 58% for Clinton. If you reverse the order of the questions with the same sample, equivalent sample, and you have another ordering and ask first, do you like Clinton? And then, how do you like Gore? The difference is extremely significantly different and amazingly different. You have 10% almost difference, people who thought that they like Gore, but then they thought, because it makes sense, but because if you start, do you like Gore? You go to global warming, nice guy, the inventor of internet, you know, all this glorious aura that he has. And then you give more points to Gore. And then if you say Clinton is a friend of Gore, okay, he's okay. So he gets more score than 53%. When you ask, for example, do you like Clinton, then you start feeling Monica Lewinsky and that, and then you get, okay, he's okay, but 53%. And Gore is a great guy, but he's a friend of Clinton, because now I have it in my... So you change the approval, right? So it depends on the context. In computer science, this is called the frame problem, which means the missing context is what makes a machine make a correct decision or not. And what we have to keep in mind here is that machines do not have all relevant information in their mind. Human beings, we don't have all information in our minds, but we have all relevant information for us in our minds when we make a decision. So, of course, my relevant information is different than your relevant information and everybody else's relevant information. But a machine doesn't even know what relevant information is. So we can frame our problems wrongly or correctly or no matter what. But it seems that biological organisms can frame their problems and can carve out from their environment the one that the information that they need to survive, to prosper, etc., where machines can get into trouble by trying to understand the context. So going back to our dear friend Emilius, nobody would have put better, as Peter would say, that the basic task is to become aware of how we objectify the world and why we lock into our objectifications once we have done so. Quality cannot be appreciated by a person obsessed with quantity. Non-local connections don't reveal themselves to localizing mindsets. Dynamic processes are not accessible to a structure-mediated worldview. Nothing of this means that we should discard the tools of modern science. It only means their use should become more discerning. Ultimately, three things matter. That we keep systems and mind open. that in fragmenting our and abstracting nature, we never lose sight of its oneness, and that we and what we count doesn't dictate for us what counts. This is, for me, encapsulates the new kind of science and what really emerges from the breakthroughs of complexity science. So we are at home with the universe, and I hope that I have convinced you that the world now looks more and more like a giant organism or a giant thought than a machine. I think that the next century, which is famously going to be the, well, this century, sorry, which is going, famously going to be the century of complexity, will help testify to that. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Vasily. Well, I think you'll agree that was really a tour de force, and it gave us a historical context for the development of these ideas, and with such clarity, and you've really given us a very good sort of frame, if I may use the term, the framing sort of solution rather than the framing problem. And I'm sure this will raise all sorts of questions. Let's just take a couple of minutes to talk to our neighbours, and just to see what we sort of points we've been picking up on. Then we've got a few minutes for questions to Vasily. So just share with your neighbours some thoughts about what you've been listening to. Okay, let's see what I'm just going to leave Vasily to field his own questions. So anyone who'd like to ask something, or even pairs of people. So we'll start with Peter.
Thank you so much for that. That was a wonderful talk, and it sparked off associations at many different levels within me. But the one which came up just like that is this idea of adding noise to a system and form coming out of it. And is this not homeopathy, where you take your dilution, and you dilute it, add more noise, up comes a pattern, dilute it, up comes a pattern. I think it's a wonderful example of what you were saying practically. And at long last, I can now explain homeopathy to my friends. Oh, come on, there may not be a molecule there, but you've got the information. Thank you.
Hello, this is Phoebe. I was delighted with a lot of your ideas. You said that the ancient maxim, as above, so below, as outside, so inside, and you also said that the universe as a being corresponds fractally to the human microcosm on a very small scale. So I came to the same conclusions in my book, Inside the Cosmic Mind. And I'd like to ask you if you've considered if this could be a justification, an explanation for things like astrology. Did you come to that conclusion yourself?
I am in the middle of your book. I read it, so I'm not. But I think yes. But in the way you describe it, in Tarnas and this kind of astrology, not. The one that...
The traditional astrology, the archetypal astrology.
The archetypical astrology of Sir Isaac Newton, yes. Yeah. But it's a fascinating book, and I think that we are... I am in the middle, as I told you, and I think that we are at the same conclusions, at the same page, so to speak, yes. I would be happy to know more about how can put archetypical Jungian astrology on the front. If I may, Jung and Pauli.
Yes.
They were.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you.
Vasilios, thank you for a wonderful talk and for making complex ideas actually very simple. And I was particularly intrigued by the way you drew some connections between people. I mean, in particular, Poincaré and Prigogine and Turin are three heroes of mine, but I never realized they met. And you described how Prigogine was actually the student of Poincaré and how Turin had this amazing encounter with Prigogine in 52. That was fascinating. But my main point is a question, and it's to do with non-locality, because I think non-locality was the word appeared in your penultimate slide, and of course non-locality is now all the rage. But I was slightly puzzled because, in a sense, a lot of what you're talking about, for example, in the wonderful pictures of the starlings, is actually a local interaction, because I think the point is there, the starlings are only interacting with their local neighbours, and yet still you get these wonderful patterns. And so I was a bit puzzled when you made the reference to non-locality, because that somehow seemed to be going against the idea of some of these simulations. So could you elaborate on that?
Okay. On the edge, let's say, there are certain aspects in these kind of swarms that they have a non-local character, but they are on the edge of the scientific method. For example, the starlings, if you calculate they have calculated the speed of local interaction propagation and how long it will take to reach the other side. It's faster than the speed of light. Of course, yes, there are some certain amazing things, but you see, these things, although published, are not taken into consideration because they say, we cannot deal with telepathy and the soul of the cloud, of the crowd. So they just dumped. But there is accumulating evidence more and more in bees also, how they change their, how they select the thing. But let me take this out of which is kind of fringe science and we have a lot of controversy. Non-locality in these kind of situations comes from a causality which is not direct. So it's not that A affects B and B affects C, more than A affects B and A affects C, and B and C appear together because they have a common cause. So they are non-locally connected in a casual sense. So these beings are not like a machine which one cog pushes the other. It's more like a hierarchical structure with a hidden, let's say, line of command, so to speak. So things are correlated, but they are not causally, they don't have the relation of cause and effect. In that sense, non-locality can appear, and there are technical publications where you have Bell inequalities and all these non-local signatures. For ordinary networks with correlations that appear in ordinary networks, no fringe science, nothing, very standard networks, which are quite nonlinear, and they exhibit non-local correlations. It's exactly like quantum entanglement. This is a very kind of hot subject. There are many papers that appear in entanglement in networks, which is quantum-like. It's not quantum, it's quantum-like, in the sense that they all communicate with something behind it. Anyway.
Hello?
Ah, sorry.
Maybe you've already answered this question, but you did make a comment earlier on, and I didn't write the whole comment down, but you mentioned that that complex systems are deterministic. Could you explain that? Because that seems to contradict what you just said. Deterministic but unpredictable. Now, that is something that my dualistic mind is having a hard time wrapping itself around. Maybe you could help me understand that. The deterministic part, especially, because, you know, what do we mean by that?
Okay, and what do we mean by predictability? Because determinism, we can say that it follows rules. It follows simple but non-linear rules, which means non-linear means that the connections are quite not easily mapped out, right? So it's an exchange which is not linear, as we saw with the noise. I mean, we increase the noise, and instead of increasing the distraction of the signal, we get clearer. So a chaotic system, by the technical definition of chaotic system, is a deterministic system which has sensitive dependence on initial condition. Now, if you take sensitive dependence on initial condition, you end up in unpredictability. Because if you have a chaotic system, if a nonlinear system, which is very sensitive to the initial conditions, no matter how close your initial conditions are, even theoretically, mathematically, so you have to have exactly the same initial condition and exactly the same boundary condition to have the same result. But the chaotic system, being sensitive in the initial conditions, exemplifies the initial error. So no matter how close you start, sooner or later you will be diffused in the... So it is predictable in the very abstract, very formal sense, if you start exactly in the same condition, but you cannot. So practically and epistemologically it's unpredictable.
We've got one more question. This session, we've got more.
Martin.
Well, that's two more in that case, and we do have more time at the end of the morning, so don't panic. And if you can remember your question till then, although it is said that you can share as you get older, you can share your secrets with your friends because they don't remember them either.
Thank you, Vasily. That was fascinating. And this is a question that, I don't know, it might be a silly question, it might be a question that Bernard can dismiss very easily. But I was wondering, thinking about your chemical reactions that seem to defy the second law of thermodynamics and they keep on evolving the structure, or the starlings, or in particular consciousness, what are the cosmological implications of this in terms of heat death of the universe? Is consciousness actually going to... stop that.
Right on one side of the paper only.
Well, I don't think that it's going to be the heat death of the universe is a nightmare of coming with a mechanistic understanding of the cosmos. I think that doesn't exist. I mean, if you face this nightmare, you see that you require a closed universe. There's no such a thing as a closed universe. I think it's an open system, and mainly because of the presence of gravity, which makes the system open. And this is Penrose and Bernard that can, the experts on that. So can consciousness avoid?
As Vasilio says, the idea of the heat death of the universe is rather passé now. Nobody believes that. That was the concept which goes back to the 19th century and is really superseded by all these ideas. And the thing about consciousness, Vasilios made a really important point when he showed the cosmic Ouroboros, which is my favorite diagram. And consciousness isn't just associated with those people at the bottom. Really, consciousness has to be associated with the whole thing. It's got to be to the very large and the very small. The conscious, the universe is conscious, which I think you also said, all the way around. And this is the mistake of the reductionists. They think that consciousness is just something associated with the bottom of the Ouroboros. It's not. It's all the way around, and actually it starts at the top, my view at least.
Very quickly, Vasilios, that was absolutely wonderful. Extending Phoebe's question on astrology, if you remember, would one say that the absolutely crucial significance of the Hermetic axiom that you mentioned, which was sheer music to my ears, can one not therefore postulate sympathetic resonance between literally all parts and all elements? So it's not just the planets and the solar systems, but the elements, the chemical atoms, the states of being, there is really sympathetic resonance, and this possibly could be something that would emerge from further complexity science. The Hermetic axiom, the ideas of non-locality, and everything that you've mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, of course, it's built into the esoteric sciences, but would you say that complexity science is now corroborating sympathetic resonance?
Yes, and this is the a good and a bad thing. A good thing because more and more young and open-minded researchers and scientists will subscribe to this idea. The bad thing is that this brings to memory to the establishment, or I mean, that this is magic and astrology and, and hocus pocus and superstition, and you cannot correlate the the flowers with the galaxy. In a way, you cannot directly, but I think that what complexity will bring in the next decades is that there will be challenging examples, like Peter mentioned homeopathy, which is a kind of sympathetic resonance. I think that we will have some developments there in very specific areas, not in general. I mean, there will be always people, and I think that hopefully this kind of new scientist will join the scientific and medical network in the next decade. But I think that this is, it has to be kind of nurtured and supported. It's not going to happen if we just let it like that. Because
it has to be managed.
Yes, because there are many great forces that don't like that. They feel that we're going back to hocus pocus and, mysterious Harry Potter kind of thing. No, really. I mean, they are actually, this is what they have been accusing.
It's a great fear.
Complexity for that we are kind of like the fifth phalanx.
We're going to try and go forwards rather than backwards. And I think we'll have to your first question in the next session because we're already 5 minutes over. And before I'm going to give Una the microphone in a second, but I'd just like you to join me in thanking Vasily for a brilliant talk.